name is John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John!
Jesus. Well, first I'd like to thank John Scott and the rest of the committee for the invitation. Really nice of you to include us in this beautiful affair. You know, and I'd like to thank Wade and Laura and Bonnie picking us up at the airport. You really made us feel at home right away. And we had a great trip in the car, and there was a lot of conversation going on. You know what a drive. It was almost like an AA meeting. It's the beauty. I am not nervous at all. Have a little hard time starting because when I stand here and look at the picture here in this room, I get very emotional. Where would we be today if it wasn't for rooms like these? It's something else. And Wayne, what an opening meeting. You are really so generous with yourself. And I have had the pleasure of knowing Wayne for a long time. And I go to the Pacific Group a few times every year on our birthdays and so on. And he is always working with somebody, helping somebody. And I love that action. It was great. And, you know, I look forward to tonight. Howard and I, we have the same sponsor now. And, you know, I had a sponsor named Charlie Vick, and he died after 31 and a half years of sobriety. And so the last 6 years, I have had John Haley as my sponsor. And he is just the same as Charlie was, and one. He's one of the most spiritual human beings I know, and he's something very special in my life. I'm so grateful that I have had two great sponsors in my life, you know, because they are very important to me. Then Marilyn will be here tomorrow morning, and you are in for a real treat. What a good selection. You know, that you really have a lot of taste. Then, Karen, of course, this morning, it's all true. You know, it would be very easy for us to stand here and talk about my wonderful sober husband and my lovely Al-Anon wife, you know, and the way we have lived for so long time now, you know, by the grace of God. But you know, but this is AA in Al-Anon, and she tells her story, and I tell mine, and it's kind of brutal at times, but it's very effective, and it sure will give other people evidence that both these programs work equally well, you know. And You know, I mean, she's something else. She was 17 years old when I met her in Stockholm. Walked around there in that office, you know, in a little cute skirt on and a sweat on, no brassiere, you know. They were kind of obnoxious, those little things. Anyhow, I have to tell you that I have quite a few friends. We have quite a few friends in this room that I love very much. We have met before these years. And you have never seen me before in a very short while. You will know me very intimately. And that's just one of the wonderful things that happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, that we can know each other on that level. You know. And little Katrina, she's here. She drove all that way from Polson, Flathead Lake, and visiting here with us this weekend, and it's great. And Karen is going with Katrina home and stayed out for the end of next week, you know. And it's just very special to us here. So, it's better I get going here, otherwise Dick Martin will get upset here, you know. You know, it can't be helped. But I come into these rooms these days, and there's always some old-timer that said, oh, him again, you know. That's what happened when you have been around for a while, you know. A while back I was invited to Flagstaff Conference, and that's a lovely affair. And the guy who invited me, he was old like myself, and I asked him, I said, you know, you invited me here 7 years ago, 11 years ago, 19 years ago, and 27 years ago. I said, why do you invite me again? He said, I wanted to hear you one more time before you die. I'm probably the most famous substitute speaker on the West Coast. And it happened long ago, or started long ago. You know, sometimes the circuit speakers, they get invited to two different locations the same weekend. And 31 years ago, Dr. Paul, you call him, he was invited to Vancouver, Canada, and to Hawaii the same weekend. And his wife, Max, wanted to go to Hawaii. So they said, why don't we send John to Vancouver? So that was my first big deal. I came up to Vancouver. There was a conference, about 4,500 people there. And Corky Berg was his name. He picked me up at the airport, drove me to the hotel where everything was going on. And we stood out in the lobby, and everybody milling around, and this lady came up to Corky and said, hi, how are you? He said, I'm really good. How are you? She said, you don't remember me, do you? And he said, sure, honey, but I'm rather busy with this gentleman right now. So she left, and I said, Corky, she wanted to talk to you. I mean, you don't have to babysit me. Everybody are friendly. Why don't you go and talk to her? So he left and came back 10 minutes later and said, that's the damnedest thing I've ever run into in my life. I said, what happened? I came over there and said, hi, how are you? And she said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, sure, honey. What meeting did I meet you at? And she said, for God's sake, man, I was your second wife. You know. Suppose there was a little bit of a blackout there, you know. I don't suppose I don't think I'm too presumptuous if I say that some of us here tonight sit with a bunch of burdens and lots of if-onlys. But be that as it may, we are here in these rooms are still the lucky ones because we have a chance. Lots of people have this thing called alcoholism, doesn't have a chance, and for various reasons. For the record, my grandfather died from alcoholic delirium in 1910. He lived in a 2,000-acre place outside Stockholm. They were breeding racehorses. But he died from alcoholic delirium. My father had a problem with his liver in 1927, and nobody knew anything about his illness then. He was a giant of a man. He radiated vitality. Women adored him. Men envied him. But he died 3 years later, and he only weighed 130 pounds when he died. And he didn't want to die at all. And he didn't have much of a chance. I was 8 years old then. And it is something to see a beautiful human being like he once was. You know, he was 6'2", and when he touched you, you realize his strength. But in 3 years, he had deteriorated to absolutely nothingness. My father was an aristocrat. He was very vain and proud and arrogant. But he was also a very loving person. But I was in violence. And thanks to our program, I have been able to deal with that. 99 out of 100 meetings I go to, we finish with the Lord's Prayer. And there's a line that says, "Forgiven as I forgive those who trespass against me." And I assure you that there was stuff in my inventory I wish I could be forgiven about. And then we can't have two standards here. I'm supposed to be forgiven. I'm supposed to have an opportunity for a new life. But anybody that did something to me, justice for them or whatever you want to call it. It's an important point because if we don't address this issue, we will come in as victims and we will remain victims and it will interfere in our own recovery, and that's why I bring it up. My older brother didn't have much of a chance for another reason. He had a little bit of pride, and it seems to be a commodity that we can't afford a luxury in this outfit. 20 years ago or so now, he lived in a castle outside Stockholm. He had a beautiful family and earned 150 grand a year, spoke 6 languages fluently, carried a Swedish flag in the Olympics on 3 occasions. But for 18 years, he lived in a room that cost 15 bucks a month to live in, drank a fifth of whiskey every night, and has lived in the past, and there was nothing ever wrong with him. I tried to 12-step him a few times. His drunk log and mine was pretty similar. But I wrote him a letter, a page and a half, what I used to be like, and 3.5 pages about all the wonders that has happened to me since I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a postcard back. It said, "Dear John, I'm sorry to hear about all your problems." So much for identification. I flew to Stockholm in 1978 and spent a couple of weeks with him. I invited him out here. He was here with me for a month. I took him to AA meetings. And he met all our wonderful friends down there in Laguna Beach and Monarch Beach and, you know, and went to the parties with us and went to the Wednesday night meeting, you know. And he had a great time that month here. And the last night he was there, you know, before he should fly back to Stockholm again, I said, "What do you think about this thing?" He said, "You don't understand. I don't want to quit. It's the only thing that's real in my life. I have sit down by myself and drink a fifth of whiskey and just live about I dream about when I was on top of everything." And I said, "I understand." And he flew home and he died 10 months later from yellow yonders. My younger brother, 18, 19 years ago, went to Scripps in La Jolla twice. And they told him his liver was shot. To make a long story short, he's still drinking. And sometimes you and I wonder, what's wrong with people like my brothers? There's nothing wrong with them. Alcohol did something for my older brother the day he died. It's still doing something for my younger brother. And that's the nature of the illness. And that's why I said in the beginning that you and I are the lucky ones because of the evidences in these rooms. People like you and I, the way we drank and carried on, we can change and live without it. And that's fabulous lives. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. How to live good out there without it. And one thing more about this insidious denial. You know, several years ago, this guy was up on this podium and he said, "Yeah, I drove down the highway in my Corvette, 140 miles an hour. I rolled it 6 times and got up on the other side and said, 'Never again am I going to buy a goddamn Chevy.'" You know? I mean, that's how we are. I talk to newcomers. I love the feelings in these rooms when our newcomers, and I like being a newcomer myself. It's very important to me. And I like to share with you why I like to be a newcomer, why I like to remember that time in my life when I had been in these rooms for about a couple of weeks, and I realized that there was something going on in these rooms. There was something called hope. I hope I never forget that fear. Many of us do. I hope I never forget the last year I drank, because I compromised on everything I believed in and stood for. I couldn't live or function without alcohol. I didn't dare to go to sleep if I didn't have a 50 whiskey in the refrigerator, because I had to have it when I woke up. And if I ran out of booze at midnight, I usually called an associate of mine in Baldwin Park and said, "Hal, next week you will owe me $150 on this particular job. But if you give me $20 tonight, you won't have to pay me $130 next week." And I drove a 100-mile round trip at midnight to pick up $20. I didn't dare to buy any booze in Baldwin Park, because then I wouldn't make it home. And when I came home to Anaheim, where we lived at the time, I bought a fifth of Imperial Bourbon for $4.85. And then I was safe, and I have to live like that, and I hope I never forget that period in my life. I know some of us, after we get a little well and get a few dollars in our pockets and bedroom privileges again, we forget how it really was. In fact, Karen cut me off 6 months before I came into AA. She really ran out of humor out at the end, I tell you. She stood up and looked at me one evening and said, "John, I wish you could find yourself a girlfriend so I wouldn't have to fool with you." She said, "You take forever." After sobriety, if you take forever, it's very commendable. It really ain't fair, folks. I was very sensitive those days. The other reason why I like to remember that time in my life is this, that I had about 90 days of sobriety, and Phil Petty talked one Sunday morning. And he stood up here and said, if you keep going to meetings, you will wake up one morning and realize and find out that you can function without alcohol. And it is not necessary to drink anymore, and you have a way to go. And I sat in that room and I said, "My God, I've experienced those feelings." And it was the first time here it dawned on me that I wasn't hooked anymore, that I had some degree of choice over my own actions. And I had already started to experience a freedom here that I hadn't had for a long, long time. And I hope I never forget the period in Alcoholics Anonymous, the knowledge that I wasn't hooked and that I was free. I hope I never take it for granted. Those are the two reasons why I like to remember that time in my life. I didn't start to drink until I was 31 years old. I know it doesn't sound so promising right now, but that's how it was. But I like to share with you how I was when I was young. First of all, the reason why I didn't drink when I was young. When my father died, I promised my grandmother I was never going to drink, so I didn't drink. When I was 19 years old, I had gone to college a year. The war broke out. I went in the Air Force for 2.5 years. And after that, I went back to college for 1.5 years, and I was selling at night, and I was trying to help my mom. It was very important to me to play the man or the house part, because my older brother was different. He was brilliant in school. He had scholarships to universities, and everything was mapped out for him. But I was different, and I could never figure him and me out in the first place. You know, this fellow, he never opened a book. He had A's in everything. I could study to 1 in the morning. I'd still fail. It really bothered me. It's still bothering me. I'm very willing. I try real hard and I can be good for a short time. But when the bottom fell out or something negative happened, I couldn't figure out why I was such a screw-up. When I was young, I had an unbelievable inferiority complex. I'm a perfectionist on top of it. Not a good combination. Contemplated suicide a lot because I knew if I died, I'd be my dad. And you see, when my father lived, I was security, prestige, and respect and those things. And I tell you what I did when I was young. I just faked it. I pretended I was really together. I was very noisy and opinionated. That gave me some false courage, and that's how I was when I was young. When I was 31 years old, I was employed by this door factory in Alhambra. My boss was alcoholic, and he taught me how to drink every day. And a new life began for me. It was the most unbelievable experience in my life, you know. You know, I never drank before. You know, we had early times at 8 o'clock in the morning, cocktails at 10, martini lunches from 12 to 2:30, made a couple of calls in the afternoon and went back to the office and typed up bids from 6 to midnight and drank whiskey. And I thought I landed in heaven. And I used to come home to Karen and say, this building business is out of this world. I said, you know, I've never felt this about my life, you know. And what booze did for me, you know, I mean, you understand how I grew up. You know, when my father died, I had a real problem with that. My mom started to send me to psychiatrists when I was 12 and 13 years old. You know, I started to live in illusions and fantasies that if I was a good kid, he was going to come back. And I lived in that till I was over 20 years old. And then I started to drink alcohol. It was just like, it gave me instant courage. It was just like I couldn't miss. I maybe worked 2 hours a day calling on the big developers. You know, the door company I worked with, Prefit Door Company, we were the first people that manufactured pre-hung door openings, you know. That was my business. And I called on these big developers down there south, you know. They are big. And a year later, I'd sold so many doors they couldn't pay me my commission. So they gave me 1/3 of the stock of the company. And I tell you, that was a terrific time in my life. You realize, Karen and I, we came over here from Sweden in 1948. And you know, you couldn't even get a job if you were an immigrant, but I had a government contract. And, you know, we came over here and we both went to work, you know, and tried to fit in and become Americans. And here, a few years later, I own 1/3 of a door factory. I tell you, it was a fabulous time in my life, you know. I mean, I tell you, that was marvelous. I had landed a big contract with American Housing Guild in San Diego, $700,000 worth of door opening. And what I'm telling you now is the highlight of my drinking career. You know, when you own a place, you're a general manager, sales manager, which I was. But I was also the truck driver. I delivered all the doors I sold. And now from before, you know, I worked 2 hours a day, you know, calling on these developers. Now I had to work 7 days a week, 16, 18 hours a day, to be up there in Alhambra where we had our little plant and pre-fitting these door opening, loading this big 2.5-ton truck. And I am up there working all day and all night and coming home to Corona del Mar where we lived at the time in a little house block from the bluff and come home there at 3:30 in the morning, having this big truck outside at you, 500 openings, you'll be delivered down to Claremont Hills in San Diego before 8 in the morning. And I come in there at 3:30 in the morning, you know, and Karen had a hot bath ready for me. And I slid in the tub down, lit a candle and inhaled, And she came in there with a pitcher of martinis and sat down and drank martinis with me. 3:30 in the morning, it's really living, you know. And I lay down in that tub and I smoked that camel and I drank that martini and I spit it out the pimento, you know. And then I usually said, you know, I'm just an immigrant and I own the goddamn place, you know. 8 years later, they fired me from my own door factory, you know.
Three beautiful girls and a son. Took them to church on Sundays. We did everything right to be Americans. The only problem with that church business was the last 4 years I drank. I was a morning drinker. She usually inspected me before we should leave, and she looked at me with those little beady Allen on ice. Not today, you know. That hurt my feelings when she took off down the street with the kids in the car, and I had to stand on the corner at home. So sometimes I ran down the block after her, screaming and hollering, you know, and my neighbors were outside talking about the lawn problem, you know, and here I came running by, and sometimes I was strangely clad, you know. She saw me in the rearview mirror coming after I in my pajamas, you know. So she stopped down the block and waited for me and rolled down the windows. What's the matter now, you know? And I said, don't forget to pray for me. And you know, at this time of my life, you know, I drank 24 hours a day. In the morning, I couldn't drink whiskey right away, then I would get sick. So I had discovered codeine cough medicine, you know. So I drank two double shots of codeine cough medicine and calmed my stomach down. Then I could drink a couple of shots of whiskey and brush my teeth and walked around with small steps and tried to look effective. And I came to church, you know, and I sat down, looked sincere, and hummed a lot, you know. I could take the sermon 20 minutes max, and then I had to have a drink. So then I just got up and said, oh, screw them all, you know what I mean. And then I went home and I drank Grand Scotch those days and played good music and became very spiritual, you know. Stan Getz and Dave Brubeck and La Boheme and Coleman Hawkins and the big bands, you know, that was kind of my music, you know. Now, after sobriety, even play Pink Floyd and Brian Ferry, you know. Dark Side of the Moon, you know. You know, I really never had any problem with alcohol until I tried to stop drinking. Ain't that the novelty, you know? You know, 1 week she says to me now, you know, you drink too much. I said, what are you talking about? She said, Johnny, you drink way too much booze. I said, well, then I quit. And then I couldn't quit. And that's when it all began. Because when I'd been off the sauce for a couple of days, I got the shakes. Then two shots of whiskey. Stopped the shakes, I could function and work. So then I had to con myself into why I had to have a couple of drinks all the time. And then I lied about it, and then I was hiding it, and from then on it got worse. When I was into 2-3 years of my drinking, I was up to 250 whiskey a day. The last year I drank, the last 10 months I drank, it didn't matter if I drank a fifth or 3/5 of whiskey a day. I also drank 2 bottles of codeine cough medicine every day, and 6 anacins 4 times a day. I was absolutely weird, you know. Those 10 months I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. The guilt was on all the time and I was no relief. And I just thought I was going crazy and I probably was. And this is a terrifying time in our life because we can't tell nobody. I was just afraid that she was going to figure out how I had to live to function. And I knew they were going to put me away somewhere. And sometimes you and I, we talk about the alcoholic loneliness. And as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing like it. Because it is a total isolation. And we drink to live and we know we are dying. There is no way out of it. And that's how it is. 2 years after the shakes began, weirder things happened to me when I stopped drinking. One morning at 4 o'clock, I sat straight up in my bed and looked in front of me. And this big white snake came out of the wall. You know, I never saw anything like it in my life. It was unbelievable. It came right out of the wall. Snow White, had 3 black eyes. He was this big in diameter on his fattest body. He was 23 feet long. And he came slowly across the room and stopped right in front of my face and started to hiss at me. I could even smell him. Kind of a Peralta high, sweet Mortier D little thing. He smells like death. And I sat down and said to myself, I said, you know, I haven't had a drink for 3 days, so it can't be the booze. Anybody hearing hallucinations and DTs, huh? Isn't that a something? You know, the closer he came, the more I screamed. And the noise in my head from my own scream reached such a crescendo, it was eventually like my brain exploded for my own screams. It finally just said, and then I blacked out and fell backwards. That was my experience with it. Karen told me in the morning, she said, something strange happened this morning around 4 o'clock. She said, you sat straight up, looked in front of you for quite a while, and then you said, ee! One night I made love to her when she wasn't even there. That's kind of tricky. She was actually laying 2 feet away from me there. She said, what are you doing over there? I said, I beg your pardon. When she realized what was going on, she started to laugh at me. I started to cry. I felt it was so humiliating to laugh at the guy who was doing his best. In the morning, I'd been out in the kitchen. I'd had my Cody and Kaufman's in my whiskey. And she met me in the hallway. And she said, well, good morning, lover boy. You know? I didn't feel any pain. I just smiled. So that's the best peace I've had in a long time. So it goes. Okay? So needless to say, I happen to love laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, that in itself is a spiritual experience. Anything that you and I have laughed a little bit about here this morning was absolutely the deepest tragedy when it happened. But when you and I, this man of identification, when it comes to this insanity and this denial, can just laugh about the whole mess, it makes it possible for us to forgive ourselves and change. It's very much part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We started over many times, and every time I had the best of intention, and every time it got worse. I tried several things before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking, you know. And, I when I grew up, I had 13 years, 2 hours a day religious education. One time I swore on the Bible in front of my wife and kids, and I said, I swear to God I'm never going to drink again. I've never broken my word of honor to you. And 2 weeks later, I'm drinking again. But I thought at that time that this thing means very much to me. Maybe that will help me to stop. You know, I went to that minister for counseling that Karen talked about this morning. For 18 months, I went to him. And he said to me one time, you have to ask God to help you. And I said, Walter, you are a good man. I'm not. You don't talk to your wife the way I talk to mine in the evening when she just looks a little strange at me. So God doesn't want anything to do with that. I've tried that stuff. And that gentleman, he read a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out how he could best help me. And he realized through the book of ours that him and I, we lacked identification, that I had to find my bottom further down alone. He even suggested a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea at all what that meant, Alcoholics Anonymous. When he wouldn't talk to me anymore, I went to a psychologist in Santa Ana. I spent $2,000 with this doctor. That wasn't anything he said to me that my wife didn't tell me for free 3 times a day, you know. That wasn't anything he said to me either that wasn't the truth. Everything he said was the truth. One time he stood up and looked at me and said, you know what's wrong with you, John? And I said, tell me, Doc. And he told it all my secrets and all my emotional problems. And I said, Doctor, you're absolutely right. And that's why I drink, because I can't stand myself the way I'm put together either. So then he laid on me, I hurt Karen and my kids. So what do you do then? You do what I did. I went in the wagon. And the tragedy with that at this stage of the deal is simply this, that the more sober we become, the more we realize how we hurt our loved ones And that in itself drives us back to drinking again, because that's the only way we know to get out from under the guilt. And so it is. There's a lot of capable people in the field of alcoholism today, but I sure don't envy them, because the nature of the illness is still the same today as when I came in. As long as alcohol is doing something for us, it is impossible for anybody talking out of using it. And that's the nature of the illness. And that's again why I said in the beginning, you and I are the lucky ones because of the evidences in these rooms. And Karen mentioned today, you know, we went to Palm Springs to start over, and she had that suicide attempt there, you know. And she locked herself in the bathroom there the second day with her. I said, I can't live like this. I'm going to commit suicide. And I laid on that bed in Palm Springs and hoping to God she would die, so she wouldn't have to be with me anymore, because I knew at that time in my life there was no way out of it for me, because I had really tried. I thought I was absolutely doomed to go through this thing, and there was no way I could live without booze at that time. 2 years after that, I came into AA. And you can draw your own conclusion how those 2 years were, and my guilt connected with it. That was the same year they fired me from my door factory. You see my attitude about that. I mean, this is my means of income. And when those guys say, sign off. I said, who needs this headache anyhow? No, I can just drink and be happy. And that's how it is. It takes everything that's near and dear from us before we are willing to try something else or whatever's going to happen to us, you know. And the last Christmas I drank, I bought a dapple gray Arabian horse. I thought if I had a hobby, I could stop drinking, you know. Bought this beautiful dapple gray Arabian horse, you know. And put him around the corral up there, and Karen said to the kids, God, he looks just like he did when he in Stockholm when everything was fine, you know. The next day I had a bunch of martinis for lunch, and I fell off the horse too. I mean, I spend a lot of money, day and a half. And 2 days before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was picked up a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock at Thrifty Mart trying to steal a pint of liquor for $3.57. And you should have seen me then. I was drunken and shaven. I weighed 246 pounds. I couldn't even defend myself. I just stood on a whim, but it can't be me. I mean, look where I came from. And I was brought up in a beautiful family and under most favorable circumstances. But that morning in Anaheim, I looked exactly like a person who has to steal a pint of liquor to live. And then came that last ultimatum you got when she said, you know, for years, because of the children, we have to stay together. But now, because of them, we have to part. And either you go down and try that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, or you have to leave again. And I've been kicked out before. So that's the only reason I went down to the Alona Club in Anaheim. And I come in down, I was a lady behind a coffee bar, said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no. Get along famously with it. Can you do something for my wife? She's crazy. You know. And that's how it is when we come in here. And we don't know it's going to work. And we got to cover our base. And I tell you another thing. Had I known how sick I was when I came in, I would never have stayed. Because stopping drinking wouldn't have fixed that. Wayne covered it last night. It's a fact, you know. And when I, by the grace of God, I call this period in my life, or that day in my life, if had we known how bad it is when we come in sometimes, we would do something much more drastic. But there's a line in the big book that covers says more will be revealed, and thank God for that line. And by the grace of God, everything happened to me the next day. I got up and I drank my codeine coffee and my whiskey. I drove down to the Alona Club and polished off a pint of Seagull 7 and came in down to, please call my wife and tell her I'm here already. You know, and they did, you know, and I said, you know, he's here, you know. And then I stood on trying to tell these guys why I couldn't be alcoholic. You know, I said, for God's sake, I live in a beautiful home. I have 3 automobiles and an English bulldog. You know, I have a horse parked down the street, you know, I play a little music and fantasize a little bit and I'm trying to put it together the next day, and that certainly can't be alcoholism. And that was a guy that listened to me, he said, that son of a bitch will never make it, you know. And
And then I went out and had four double martinis for lunch and came back and asked them to call her again and tell her I'm here for the second time to show how sincere I was. And then I should go home and buy a fifth and say I've been to AA three times today, you know. But that was this guy that stood and had listened to me that morning, never said anything. And what happened to me there was really what there's a pamphlet called Alan McGinnis pamphlet, Members I View Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's the best pamphlet we have when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and alcoholism, you know. Because there he talks about the first miracle that happens to a newcomer coming to an AA meeting. And everywhere else we go, say, you know what's wrong with you? You come into an meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what was wrong with me, and this is what I have done about it. And we don't put the newcomer on the defensive right away. You know, we wish them welcome, sit down and have a cup of coffee. And Charlie Vick was his name, and he said, Johnny, why don't you come home with me and let us talk? I said, okay. It was so pathetic, you know. You know, I hear many people say, you know, I rebelled against everything. I told everybody to screw themselves, you know. I really never did. I did the best I knew all my life, and it still beat me in every area of my life. It really is a tragedy. So Charlie said, I said, okay. So we sit in his patio, and he tells me his story. And that's what I think is important in Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another. The identification between the two. When he was through, I realized he was worse than I was, and he depended more than I did on it, and he was sober. And I said, you were that bad and you can stay off the sauce? And he said, yeah. And I knew he was telling the truth, but I tried to wiggle out of it one more time. I said, Charlie, you don't understand, every time I stop drinking I get the shakes and weird things happens to me when I stop drinking. He said, Johnny, you will only shake for 4 or 5 days, and then you never have to shake again as long as you live. And I didn't know that. I sat down and I thought, what the information this guy is coming up with here, you know. And he tells me about the disease of alcoholism. He called it an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And he said, the first drink is a mental one to make you comfortable. Then the body takes over and creates more booze, and you cannot control your pattern. Or you're living. So things made a little bit of sense to me that afternoon. I was in a meeting that night when they read a portion of chapter 5 that we heard here before the meeting. I just said, please God help me today to stay sober. And it wasn't a big deal. You know, I always thought the spiritual experience would be something like, yes, John, what can I do for you? You know. But it wasn't like that at all. It was merely a feeling. And my thoughts were these, that perhaps after all this, dies away from me too. When I came home that night, I said to Karen, I said, you know, it happened to me tonight. I don't have to drink anymore. And she did say, your eyes look different. I haven't had to drink alcohol or any codeine cough medicine, strange pills or funny cigarettes since that day. And it's 36 years and 8 months and 26 days ago. And you all knew, you might sit down and say to yourself that it must be easy for you to have all that time on the program. But it wasn't easy then. It's what we are dealing with right now. You know, I was not a great success when I came into alcohol. I had a lot of anxieties about my kids. I wanted to be a good father. I knew I wasn't most of the time. I was $36,000 in the hole, and they were all small bills, and they were all due. And Karen's suicide attempt just drove me crazy. It's very hard to live with yourself when you realize that you're broken another human being's spirit. But I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And that's all I had going for me for quite a while. But I just like to tell you all new. Those first 2 months of my sobriety, I couldn't handle nothing. When the phone rang at home, I just pointed at it. I said, and then I split and hid in my closet. I sat on the floor in my closet and wept. I was scared to death about those phone calls. I had about 10 days of sobriety. I sat in a stag meeting and blurted out. I said, You guys don't understand, but I feel so goddamn guilty. And that was an old timer like Howard that said, the reason you feel so guilty is because you're guilty. And there were guys like that that saved my life. And for the first time, I could admit it was my fault for without my salvation. As long as you pin it on somebody else or something else, nothing can happen to you. But I just came to the conclusion, whatever they had done or she had done or said, I drove them to it. When I took it on that basis, I was free. But when that meeting closed that night, it was probably the most crucial time for me here, because I felt trapped. I felt I was in a corner I couldn't get out of. I actually regretted that I'd copped out and admit it was my fault. The only thing I had going for me here then was this, that I knew under no circumstances could I go back to drinking again. No matter what, I couldn't escape through booze anymore. I'd done enough damage. I had no more rights when it came to liquor. And whatever was coming my way, I just had to face the music. But I couldn't split with booze anymore. So I'd actually taken the first two steps in this program and didn't know it. But how do you turn your will and life over to care of God as you understand Him? What's the spiritual experience in these rooms? That happened to me moments later the same evening. As I stood out alone and afraid, this guy came up to me. I never saw him before. And he just comes over and put his arm around me and said, Johnny, everything is going to be all right. And I believed him. And that's how it began for me with a higher power. It was just those guys at my welfare talk, and I just trusted them. For quite a while, those same guys actually gave me the courage to face my wrongs and my difficulties. And they talked to me in a fashion I never experienced before, because they didn't point fingers. There was no judgment. They just shared their own experiences from heart to heart. And this love and this care that goes on in these rooms is really the most healing commodity that we can offer or being offered. Suits us back to good health, and it gives us a God of our very own that we can trust under any condition. It's here for everybody. Nobody is excluded. Karen didn't believe I was going to stay sober when I came in. It took 2 years of sobriety before she realized I meant business. And you know, we come in here and we hope they will believe us, you know. But I understood another thing, that she didn't dare to believe it. Those last 4 years I drank, I'd been on the wagon several times, and every time that we became friends again, I always went back to drinking again. So she didn't dare to believe that I was going to stay sober. You see, when it comes to trust, it's nothing we can demand. It's something we have to earn. And that's what the day at a time is all about. And besides that, there's a lot of stuff that's going on in these rooms between you and me. We come in here, you're doing fine, and in there it's going to get better. We have this all support group here, and we don't have to go through nothing alone anymore. It's incredible. I had 60 days of sobriety when Charlie comes to me and he says, sobriety got to be the number one in your life. And I said, no, my kids comes first. I love them all my own life. Charlie said, without sobriety, you won't have them. And you have a letter in your pocket to prove it, which was true because I was kicked out at the time. I said, well, then my business, I got to pay them bills. And Charlie said, you know, you drank up a door factory, you're 36 grand in the hole right now. If you don't stay sober, whatever you're doing, you'll blow that too. And every yabbat I came up with, he plugged my wheel. It's true. Without sobriety, I don't have a chance at all. And then he says, there's no conditions on sobriety. I said, what do you mean, no conditions? If she could forgive me, my job started to go a little better, I could consider this damn thing. He said, Charlie said, there's no conditions on sobriety, because one of the conditions you come up with might not come true. Then you blame AA for it and go out and drink again. And ladies and gentlemen, for one reason or another, I bought the package. So now sobriety is the number one in my life. There's no conditions on sobriety. Then things happen to us in this room, because I tell you how it was in my life after 60 days of sobriety. You know, I'm up early, I go to work early. Karen met me in the hallway and said, yeah, before you had the booze as a crutch, now you have those damn meetings. Are you that kind of a weakling you can't stand on your own two feet? I said, I suppose so. And then I go out to work all day. And then I come home at 5:15 to have dinner before I go to my meeting. I have 25 phone calls about the people I owe the money to. And I was absolutely paranoid about that. I mean, you know, that I hadn't even started to get an income after 60 days of sobriety. And there's very few people like in my condition come into Alcoholics Anonymous, then write a check for 36 grand and say, here, take it and shove it and don't bug me anymore. You know, and I mean, I couldn't do that. And I came to Charlie instead. And I said, Charlie, they want my money. He said, no, they want their money, he said. And to make a long story short about that, ladies and gentlemen, I went on a strict budget. And I worked hard and I bought money orders twice a month. And it took me 4.5 years to pay back that $36,000. And when I was through with that financial amends, there was no resentment. I had bought my freedom. And it was a very important part of my program, and those financial amends. So that night I had a quick bite to eat. I go to my meeting. I have a reprieve here for 1.5 hours. Then I come home at 10:30. I'm supposed to thank God for my sobriety that day. And I lay down in my bed and I said, God, what a terrible day I've had. What an absolutely terrifying day I've had. I said, yeah. But I didn't drink. I said, what's going on here? I used to get drunk over a lot less. And then it begins, because then we start to realize that this thing called sobriety, it's mine. It's my own. It's the only decent thing that has happened to me in a long time. It must be some sort of a gift or something. And then begins the consistency in our living, and then we add to it. And from now on, everything is God's business, good and bad. And if He's part of the bad stuff must just be a period within a period. And we have gone through that period, we realize why we had to go through it, and it all started to fall in place. So this thing called sobriety, that's the big deal here. Many people say, when will my ship come in? This is the ship. But there is more to it than that. The admission and the acceptance is part of that gift. It says in chapter 3, we have to concede to our innermost self we are alcoholics. That's the first step of recovery. The admission and the acceptance and the sobriety itself, those three things to me is a divine intervention, because 9 out of 10 alcoholics never make it because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics either die or go crazy from this illness because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics have periods of sobriety, go in and out of care units, in and out of treatment centers, in and out of meetings of alcoholics now because they don't buy what I'm talking about. It's a fact. And today we have addicts, alcoholics. What's the difference? Heroin addict doesn't identify with the people on coke. The people on coke feel superior to alcoholics for one reason or another. Maybe the price tag have a little bit of snob appeal, I don't know. And they see if I had a program like Alcoholics Anonymous. Coke Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous have a lot of credibility today, a lot of people staying off that stuff, going to those meetings. But what's wrong with us? Why is it only 1 out of 10 of us that have a consistency in sobriety? It's like Clancy said, my case is different. I don't really identify like an alcoholic like them. You know, I mean, you cover it hell of a good, you know. And that's a fact, you know. And there I stood that night and I looked. I said, why was I so lucky that I saw it and ran with it? Why didn't my brothers? They needed this as much as I did. How many people have you and I tried to 12-step over the years? They don't want what we got. It's incredible. And one little more thing about addicts, alcoholics, what is the difference? An addict is trying to get out of reality. You and I are trying to fit into reality. But the recovery program is the same. Total abstinence and the 12 steps. And I have watched you addicts now for over 30 years, and you don't seem to drink a hell of a lot better than we did. You know. So join what you're supposed to join. You can't beat this rap. You know. So here, my sobriety is right. My AA life is good. My work started to go better. The kids come home from school and say, "Hi, Dad, can we talk?" Now the kids are in place. Every day you and I stay sober, life is getting better in spite of us. And there have been days in my life, in my sobriety, the only thing that was right that day was that I didn't drink that day. It's worthwhile to fight for. Don't give up before the miracle happens. Okay, don't go to sleep on me now, Dave. Okay? Okay. Then 2 years later, Karen came and said, "You know, it wasn't always your fault." I said, "Now I can die." You know? Long ago, she said, "You know, this life we live today is really the most fabulous adventure. It was so hopeless and so tragic at one time, completely turned around. And there's even a degree of innocence between us today, and that's almost impossible to believe. But that has come to pass because she is just as busy now as I'm in AA. We have seen so many people over the years have turned around, start to be good to one another. Nothing is in vain. All that bad stuff is going to benefit somebody else down the line, so don't even worry about it, you know. And sometimes you and I wonder, what amends can I make to the loved one to straighten everything out? There's no profundity here. It has nothing to do with intention, promises, gifts. We can't bribe them no more. It doesn't matter how many good things you and I do when we come home drunk. It's all canceled out. The only amends we can make to ourselves and our loved one is to stay off the booze a day at a time. The rest of the program will follow little by little, but God, it starts somewhere. You know? So the first obstacle I have at when I was here in my life, in my program, Charlie said that I had to take my inventory. I said, makes no difference if I take that goddamn inventory, you know, it's so painful. And Charlie said, "Well, if you don't take your inventory, you ain't going to stay sober." And I said, "I'm going to prove to you it means nothing." That's the attitude I had. So I wrote my inventory down, you know. And then I called him and I said, "I'm going to take the fifth step with you." So then I read the fifth step with Charlie. And the strangest thing happens after I had done that. I hadn't counted on it. It was just like I fulfilled the contract for sobriety, that I didn't have to worry about getting drunk again. And another thing that happened that I hadn't counted on, I had a deep feeling that God had forgiven me. I hadn't counted on that. Another thing happened, that I realized that, you know, we both had problems. And I realized that if I would interfere and tell them what they were doing wrong, they would have to defend it even more so, and it was going to get worse instead of better. So I stayed out of those things and didn't bother about that. And when I didn't bother about that, a few months later, the fear there got less and less. So then she talked to her sponsor, and she got free. You know, I even realized through my inventory that all my defects of character and shortcomings. There was a repetition throughout my life in the same area. When I was 7 and 9, 12, 13, 14, 15, 17, 18, 21, 22, 30, I made the same mistakes. I could never admit I was wrong. I could never accept defeat, you know, and I'm going to prove to you bastard that I can do it, you know, on and on and on, and all my defects that I had dealt with all my life, you know. And I just went down on my knees and I said, "God, I've denied all my life that I am like this. I've taken the opposite point of view. I've said it isn't so. With all my technique and willpower, I can do nothing about these things. And therefore, I give them to you, and you can remove them on your time and your terms." You see? And that's what happened to me there. And that's a very important one. I hear sometimes guys say, "I'm going to go home and work on my defects of character and shortcomings." It would be the same as the booze. The more we work on it, the worse it's going to get. It's just a self-obsession. There's no intellectual solution to an obsession. There has to be a power greater than ourselves in our life to handle those things. And that's what the pulse of nature and the heartbeat in Alcoholics Anonymous are all about. The lack of power is our dilemma. And we need a power greater than ourselves in our life. And that has to do with the defects of character and shortcoming. So, now we are there. I know I have a Rolex here and I'm almost at noon here. Can I get another 10 minutes? Okay. Or do you mean I should wrap it up or something? No. Well, so now we, how should I say it? Don't worry, it's coming. You know, this way of life, program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is nothing like the face of this earth, you know. And you know that I went to 7 meetings a week the first year I was sober. I've gone to 5 meetings a week ever since. I'm up early, late to bed, I work very hard. It's a privilege as far as I'm concerned. And many people say, Jesus, what a schedule that guy has. I tell you, I live more normal than normal people do. The only difference I'm aware of it. You know, it's a fact. I see many people today, they have a bunch of sobriety. 12, 14, 24 years sobriety. Quit going to meetings. Don't have time. Other things become more important. It saddens me. All the people I looked up and admired when I came in, you know, they worked hard. They were up early and late to bed. They worked very hard. They were in meeting all the time, helping others. You know, and that's what we are supposed to do. That's the only requirement here. We give away what we got, this gift. And then, you know, and I like to share with you, 24 hours a day, that's what we have. For 22 and a half hours, I'm a husband to my wife. You know, we have been married for 52 years now. And I tell you, we have both utilized our sponsors to get where we are. And it took a little bit of work of changes here, you know. I was, when she had another opinion or something, I had to prove to her she was wrong, because I was so insecure that it had to be what I said that was right, you know. And, you know, and I really was a pain in the ass, I tell you, for years. And you know, yes, she nods her head. And, you know, and I mean, now if she has another opinion, I said, oh, what a concept. You know. we have a ball together. We love to be together. We are together a lot. You know, I have my office at home, and we spend a lot of time together. We have a great life together, you know. I never liked bargains. If it wasn't the best goddamn marriage there ever was, I wouldn't like to have it, you know. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what it is. It is the best marriage. I mean, we love to be together, and we have fun together. I tell you, our secret, our success is we give each other a little space and we don't have to agree on everything, you know. And if we blow up sometimes and have a little argument, I can't stand. I used to go and sulk for 2-3 days, you know. But now after about half an hour, I go in and I tell her, I said, I tell you what I'll do. I'll forgive you. And the kids, you know, they were 13, 10, and 8, and 6 years old when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been their father for part of their lives since that age group. You know, I taught them how to swim and dive and play tennis. They had that horse I fell off for over 10 years. I relived my youth with them. I have experienced everything with them that I wish my father could have experienced with me. And it's just like I have sensed his presence here in this journey on Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's a fabulous thing, you know. And little Katrina here, she's 14 years and 11 months and one day sobriety in his life. Next month he has 15 years in the program, you know. And her husband has 25 years of sobriety. They have a beautiful little boy and a girl and have the best life here in Montana, and we miss her a lot, you know. And she's quite a person. So she's here, and I'm surprised. And then I work hard, you know, and I love my work. I'm busier than hell right now. It's a great life. But that's 22 and a half hours. But for 1.5 hours, I'm with you. I love to be with you. I don't come here because I'm worried about that I'm going to start to think screwy. I love to be. I don't want to miss out on anything because we hear so many miracles that happen in these rooms. You can look at it yourself. I mean, where we were and where we are today after our period of the program of alcoholics, it's impossible. You know, when I came in, I never fit in. I was never part of it, you know. And all the stuff out there, I had such problems out there in that world. And thanks to this way of life that you and I have, I fit in, I'm part of it. I tell you, I'd be so bold to say, you and I, we live out there like we don't have the illness. Tell that to a guy who has heart and cancer. We are no victims. You and I, thanks to this way of life, have an opportunity to participate in life and living. Nobody else have the breaks that you and I have. And so, you are new. If you can, just believe me, we only wish you well. We only want good things for you. If you can just believe that and take that with you, you will never wake up lonely anymore, because you know by now there is a way to go and to live. You know, and you think about God's will, my will. What about this day at a time sobriety? Think about it this way. Abstinence is a spiritual environment. It isn't natural for alcoholics not to drink. As long as you and I have abstinence, we have a chance. Because we sit in these rooms and we have our sponsor and we have each other. And we identify, we have moments of clarity. See, as long as you and I have abstinence, we have a chance. I cannot for a moment believe that God would let us go through all those things, then bring us in here and show us this way to live if he didn't have any plans for us. It really wouldn't make any sense at all. So you all knew, do this, do what we do. Don't drink and come to meetings. It's the best deal in town. Thank you.